And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Hamilton County Commissioner Todd Portune has been a household name in local politics since the early 1990s. But on Thursday, the Democrat, who defied the odds nearly 20 years ago by winning a seat on the commission, says he's retiring after his cancer has spread. Portune says he has the fight of his life ahead. So we begin the Friday news review with WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman, who was at the announcement. Hi, Jay.
Hi there.
Well, let's talk about Todd Portune and what he said yesterday.
I think we sort of knew that this announcement was coming, that he probably was – there was rumors started when the announcement – that they announced that he was going to have this announcement on Thursday, Wednesday, that it was pretty well given that he probably wasn't going to seek reelection. I think what surprised a lot of people was that his cancer has returned. And as you mentioned, he's had a long battle, a 20-year battle. It started with some tumors in his spine that eventually would cause him some paralysis. He battled back from that. It was not easy, but he was able to walk with the assistance of crutches. And even last 2 years ago, he had to have part of his left leg amputated because they found more cancer. But he was told that was the only place that he had cancer. He took precautionary chemotherapy. Earlier this year, he had a little accident in his home where he hurt his spine again and ended up back in a wheelchair. And one would assume that when they were treating that, then that they, did some scans and they found that he had a spot that they were watching. He did some experimental chemo from, as he described it, Memorial Day to Labor Day, and it was not effective, and his cancer has spread, and he says that the challenges ahead of him, he's not able to do the job that he thinks he needs to be able to do to continue to be a commissioner, and so he's decided that he's not going to run for reelection.
And there also seemed to be a lack of clarity on whether he was sure whether he would be able to finish his term.
Yeah, he was very clear that it was not a resignation. It's not a retirement. I mean, he's retiring from politics. So he's not going to run again, but he's not resigning right now. But he would not. I mean, he was pretty clear that he wasn't sure that he would be able to serve out all of his term, which runs till January 1st of 2021.
What kind of cancer does he have?
He wasn't very specific about that. We know that he has cancer. We know that, whatever the chemotherapy was an experimental treatment. I'm not even sure that we got the sense that if those treatments are going to continue, because one of his quotes was, it's clear to me whether it's undergoing treatment or not, that the physical impact on me in the future is going to be extremely challenging and difficult and painful.
He's someone that we've watched deal with this for a long time. He's been in local politics for almost 30 years, really, certainly more than 25. Let's talk about the beginning of his local political career. It did start at City Hall.
Right. And it just escaped me. But he ran for an office prior to being appointed to city council that I didn't know about till yesterday until I read it in another news article. But he was appointed to Cincinnati City Council in 1993. Was successfully elected to council four times, 93, 95, 97, and 99. 99, he would have been term limited because you can only serve 8 years. So he launched a campaign in 2000 to be a Hamilton County Commissioner and was successful in that and has been a county commissioner ever since. And they're doing some research. I don't know that they've got a definitive answer, but it's possible that he is the county's longest serving commissioner, but they're still trying to verify that.
And this is significant because while Hamilton County has turned blue, as they say, with a fully Democratic commission now, he was elected years ago when that was uncommon.
When it was still red.
What do we remember about 2000 or so when he ran and was elected the first time?
Probably he benefited from the fact that there were a lot of people that were not very happy with the stadium. Hamilton County voters in 1996 voted to increase the sales tax to pay for new stadiums for the Reds and the Bengals. The Bengals stadium was built first. It had major cost overruns. To this day, there are many say that the Bengals got a very sweetheart deal at the expense of the county, and there was a lot of frustration with that. The commissioners who negotiated that lease at the time, and Bob Bettinghouse was one of those commissioners, and that's who Todd challenged in 2000 and was able to beat him and become the first Democrat. It was either 35 or 40 years since there had been a Democrat elected to the county commission.
And while Cincinnati has Democratic voters and has for a long time, I mean, in a countywide race, you've got the more Republican suburbs to deal with if you're a candidate and right. a Democratic candidate at that. How did he manage to endear himself countywide to be reelected so many times?
I think this was even brought up yesterday. If you saw the picture with the folks standing behind him, it was a mix of political party. It was not all Democrats. It was not all Republicans. He was able to reach across. Certainly there were, you know, Republicans who did not agree with some of his positions. But, you know, he's been able to bridge that divide and work with people to try to come up with solutions.
What does it mean for the commission politically? These are some coveted jobs for local politicos. This will open up a seat.
Correct. We haven't heard a lot from Democrats who may be interested. We do know that there is one announced Republican, Andy Black, who is a businessman who lives in Indian Hill. He insists that he's staying in the race. Our Howard Wilkinson has talked to folks on the Hamilton County Republican Party who said, you know, now that Todd is stepping aside, that they may be trying to find a bigger name candidate to run for that race. But so far, I've heard a couple of names. I don't know that I'm comfortable saying them on the air on the Democratic side, but they're bigger name folks who might be interested in running for Todd's seat.
And when you say bigger names from the Republican side, does that suggest that perhaps they write this one off because they wouldn't have seen an opportunity to defeat Pertun had he run for re-election?
That's my impression, that they didn't want to challenge that they – and even a couple years ago, maybe a couple cycles ago, there was an agreement between the Republicans and the Democrats that basically the Democrats didn't challenge Chris Monzel, and Chris Monzel didn't challenge there was no Democrat to challenge Chris Monzel because of that agreement.
Just sort of a gentleman's agreement
right.
on who gets to control the seat. What do you think, as a reporter that covers these things, that Todd Pertun will be remembered for in his years of service?
I think Howard Wilkinson, and I hate to keep referring to Howard Wilkinson, but I think he did well on Facebook this morning, that probably more than anything, his courage. I mean, he could have well given up when he was in, I think it was 2002, 2003, with the initial paralysis. They told him that he would never probably walk again, and he did. And actually was doing pretty well until the incident, you know, where he had to have part of his leg amputated. And lots of places where folks would have just said, enough, I'm going to step aside. And he kept going, kept a full schedule. Even when he was in the hospital, he had aides bringing him work, made phone calls, and did work from the hospital, even while undergoing surgery and chemotherapy.
Well, our thoughts will be with him as he battles this next round of cancer that he's dealing with. WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman, thanks so much for coming in and talking to us.
Thank you.
I do want to read some statements that have been issued on behalf of Todd Pertun and his announcement. Mayor John Crownlee says, quote, "In addition to improving our community in thousands of ways, the eternal values of human rights Commissioner Pertun has fought for will be the most important and enduring of his legacy. He fought for gay rights before it was popular, against police brutality before it was popular, for disability inclusion before it was popular, for harm reduction and addiction help before it was popular, for all minorities and for those who had no voice. That's the legacy his kids will know, and I will trumpet. It's the legacy that has inspired all of us, myself included." That was Cincinnati Mayor John Crownlee. Part of the statement from the Ohio Democratic Party on Hamilton County Commissioner Todd Pertun's decision not to seek re-election. "Hamilton County has become a reliably blue county in both local and statewide elections, and the Democrat who started it all was Todd Pertun, running a courageous and gutsy race to win a county commission seat in 2000. Ever since, he's been a mentor to an entire generation of Hamilton County Democrats, blazing the path for others to succeed. I was fortunate to be one of the beneficiaries of his generous support, wise guidance, and warm friendship." That was a statement from the Ohio Democratic Party and David Pepper, who is the chairman of that. The County Democratic Party in Hamilton County says, "From leading enormous projects like the Banks development to helping individual homeowners with a flooded basement, Todd has worked tirelessly on every problem and opportunity he has faced as a Hamilton County Commissioner and Cincinnati City Council member." Former Mayor Mark Mallory says, "Commissioner Todd Pertun's public service stands out as an example of true commitment and selfless duty to the people of Cincinnati and Hamilton County. He has faced unimaginable challenges, yet he has shown remarkable strength and courage in his effort to fight for what he believes in. He worked on many issues of importance to many people. Most memorable to me was Commissioner Pertun's crucial work to get a deal done to finally build the banks. Todd has been a friend for many years, and I wish him the best. That's former Cincinnati Mayor Mark Mallory. And a lot of our listeners and readers have chimed in. One comment from our website: Todd Purtune is the living example of what elected representatives should do and how they should act on behalf of the larger society. That was a comment from Dave Bean on WVXU.org. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The Cincinnati Bell Connector, better known as the streetcar, is now 3 years old, and a similar operation is running in Kansas City. So is there something that the Show Me State can show us about our own public transit system? The Friday News Review continues now with WCPO reporter Pat LaFleur. Hi, Pat.
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Happy Friday to you.
And to you.
You recently went to Kansas City to check out their streetcar there.
I did.
So tell us why that city's operation is worthy of comparison to what we're trying to do here.
Sure. There are a number of reasons. First of all, the city of Kansas City and the city of Cincinnati, I found, have a lot of similarities just in general. They're both river cities. They have kind of hilly terrains throughout their downtown and central business district. When it comes to the streetcar itself, literally they're identical vehicles. They were purchased in a batch together in order to get a better rate. Cincinnati and Kansas City kind of pooled their resources to acquire these vehicles. As far as distance, they're roughly the same distance. As far as route, Cincinnati is a little shorter, and it gets a little technical. It's a little longer as far as track mileage, but a little shorter as far as the distance between the two poles of the system, as it were. So we're talking about Rheingeist in the north down to the banks. That's about 2 miles, which is about the same as what Kansas City's system runs. And, you know, the neighborhoods that they connect are very similar. They connect dining destinations. They have a very similar open-air farmer's market to Findlay Market. They call their City Market. That's at one end of their system, connects their downtown business district, and then arts and entertainment as well. So there are all these very similar facets to these systems, and they also launched about 3 months apart back in 2016, Kansas City launching in May, and then Cincinnati here launching in September, a few months later.
You mentioned similar lengths. Now, we know that at least when the Cincinnati streetcar was first proposed, there was an idea that it would be a little longer. It would go uptown
and That's right.
maybe to points beyond at some point down the road. Does Kansas City have similar hopes?
Yeah, so they are poised to more than double the size of their system. They're going to be taking it another 3 miles south down to the University of Missouri Kansas City campus, and that's the big kind of urban college campus that they have. And there's another similarity we have is that originally the Cincinnati streetcar was conceived to run up the hill to Clifton and connect to the University of Cincinnati. So they're kind of realizing the next step in their system, whereas, you know, we're still working to make sure that what we have is working as efficiently as possible.
Well, let's talk about ridership, because that's always the point of contention, whether it's actual data or just anecdotal social media posts. Are people using the Kansas City streetcar?
So I'll start with anecdotal. So when I was there, I rode the streetcar for most of a Tuesday and a Wednesday, starting around lunchtime. Around 11, 11:30 is when I would hop on to start talking to people. And this was during the middle of the week in mid-August was when I visited. There were no seats to sit on this thing in the middle of a weekday of just people getting lunch, coming downtown to use the streetcar to get around, people who work downtown using it to get to lunch. So a lot of what is envisioned for our streetcar is being realized there in this way, but we're not seeing that kind of midweek ridership. Now, as far as data goes, typically Kansas City is averaging around 6,000 rides a day. For the Cincinnati streetcar, that's a pretty high number for a month of ridership. So it's a really big, big data difference between how many people are riding Kansas City's streetcar versus how many people are riding ours here.
6,000 a day in Kansas City versus
on average,
about 6,000 on a good month.
On a good month, right. So most months are below that. I would say around 4,000 a month is kind of the middle of the road if we look over the course of 3 years.
So Kansas City can transport 6,000 a day. I hate to put you on the spot, but do you know offhand what the Cincinnati streetcar could accommodate per day if it were more thriving in terms of passenger?
Well, I would imagine that we could accomplish the same thing. And I say that because the vehicles are literally identical. They have the same capacity. And we actually just recently got all five of our vehicles up to standard to run on the tracks. That was kind of a big milestone that just occurred last month. City Council kind of spoke about it in one of their committees a couple weeks ago. So as far as capacity, we have just as much ability to carry as many people as they do. It's a matter of removing barriers or enticing people to use it that I think starts to get at the difference between these two systems.
So you mentioned barriers and enticement. Why is ridership so low here?
Well, that depends on who you ask.
Well, I'm asking you.
Right. So, you know, I could talk for probably a full hour about this, but there are a few things that I noticed right off the bat. One is that it's free to ride in Kansas City. It's always been free to ride. It's been free to ride from the very start. They've never had to deal with faulty ticket vending machines. They've never had to deal with credit card readers that don't work. They've never had to deal with riders have never had to learn how to use a new app in order to buy a fare. It's a sort of system where if you're walking down Main Street in Kansas City and you hear that bell coming up behind you and you see a streetcar stop ahead of you, you can kind of just jog up to it and hop right on. And these streetcars have sensors that can count people boarding and disembarking. So, you know, removing that ticket barrier is one of the biggest factors that I saw there in Kansas City.
What about the difference in the governance of the two local communities? Is there a more pro-streetcar sentiment in Kansas City than we might find here in Cincinnati?
Well, I think as far as politics go, there's definitely a distinction to be drawn between the two mayors who've kind of overseen the launch of these two systems. And in Kansas City, you have Sly James. He just left his second and last term as mayor. And he really kind of championed this from the very beginning. Whereas here in Cincinnati, kind of across the board, there's been political friction about this project from the very start that wasn't necessarily playing out nearly as dramatically in Kansas City as it has played out here.
What do you anticipate that these ridership numbers, what role will they play when there's conversations about revisiting that extension to Uptown?
Well, I think ridership is kind of a moving target in one sense, but I'm in all of my reporting on the streetcar, I still have yet to decide how much I believe ridership actually drives the investment in a system like this. And there have been a number of counts across the greater Cincinnati community about how much real estate investment has popped up as a result of this. This public works project is really what it comes down to, laying tracks in the road and it being a permanent fixture to that streetscape. So, you know, I've heard anything from several hundred million dollars, even up to $1 billion, people are estimating that has popped up in investment around this streetcar. Now, whether or not that was all driven by the streetcar specifically is another question that I don't have the answer to here. But that said, I think ridership is the most visible thing that people can kind of wrap their heads around when they're deciding, is this worth putting in? Because, you know, real estate investment, that's kind of abstract and very long term. What's very immediate and in front of people's faces every day is whether or not the streetcar is empty or whether or not people are using it. And I think that's where the optics of it really starts to play in here.
We do hear media reports relatively frequently about the investments that are taking place along the streetcar line. And it just begs the question whether it is related, as you sort of referenced there, because sure, you've got all these nice buildings being rehabbed or constructed, new businesses opening up, but how can you credit the streetcar if there's nobody on it?
Well, and you know, again, it's going to come down to each individual investor who is deciding to rebuild an old building along the route or build a new development along the route. And some think about the streetcar. Others might be thinking about the development of Washington Park or the recent rehabilitation of Music Hall. There are so many factors at play, especially in the Over the Rhine district of the streetcar right now, that it really does become difficult until you start talking to people on an individual basis about why they decided to invest in that particular parcel. So it's hard to really pull that all together and know or identify where the streetcar is a factor and where it isn't.
Were you seeing development like this along the line in Kansas City?
Yeah, so there was one business owner that I spoke with his family has been operating a business in what's known as the Crossroads neighborhood. It's an arts and entertainment district right next to their central business district. His family's been there since 1905. So he's seen really this – he and his family have a long history there. So before the streetcar, his account was a lot of empty warehouses, not a lot of development around him. And he will talk day and night about how much investment has popped up around the streetcar there.
We got a tweet from Brad Thomas responding to your tweet, of course, that you sent out about your appearance on the show today. Here's an easy one. He says, remove the traffic light at Race and Green. It literally serves two one-ways pointing in opposite directions. Streetcar gets stopped there approximately 25 times a day for what he says is no reason. We got an email from Steve in Oakley. He says, mass transit, hardly. 3 years in, and the ridership numbers certainly don't come close to fall into that category. The ridership numbers still hover at less than half the ridership numbers that were projected for Tiger Grant applications. Half, he emphasizes. That Steve in Oakley. You're working on another streetcar story that you say will come out on Monday?
Yeah, that's right. And that actually gets to Brad's tweet about optimizing the traffic signals and removing these kind of physical barriers that tend to create blockages or other delays on the streetcar route, making it late. That's been a big complaint from day one, is that the streetcars aren't keeping up with the schedule that they've promised. So I'll be kind of digging into the blockage numbers, doing a little bit of comparison with Kansas City. That's a tougher comparison to draw, but they are seeing fewer of those incidents that lead to the streetcar being behind schedule. So I'll dig into some of that. That'll be coming out on Monday morning. To Steve's point about ridership, that really gets to kind of this question of how do we measure the success of this thing? Do we measure it by the number of people riding, or do we measure it by the amount of investment that's being built around it? Is it economic development, or is it transit? And I still don't think here in Cincinnati we have a clear answer for that.
Okay, just 10 seconds left. Did we learn anything new about pedestrian safety this week?
Pedestrian safety. Well, we had a pedestrian safety summit yesterday. I unfortunately was not able to attend myself, but I saw our own reporting out of it. And the speed camera conversation is kind of coming up. We've done a lot of reporting on that at WCPO. It'll be interesting to see how city council decides to proceed with it would require a charter amendment. So we'll see where that goes.
Pat LaFleur is a transportation reporter at WCPO. Pat, thanks for coming in.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
Up next, a federal judge gives leverage to local communities on how to handle settlement funds obtained from lawsuits against the makers and distributors of opioids. And mysterious anti-Chinese flyers show up in the mailboxes of Ohio voters. Why? The Friday News Review continues after this short break. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The Friday News Review continues now with Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Terry DeMio. She has stories about how local communities can address settlement funds from lawsuits targeting the makers and distributors of opioids. She's on the phone with us. Hi, Terry.
Hi, how are you, Michael?
I'm doing well. Happy Friday to you. And I see that you've done some more reporting on our opioid crisis, this time related to these lawsuits that are taking place across the country. Why don't you give us the latest on what you found?
Sure. So I think many people are aware that 2,000 some communities are suing the manufacturers and distributors of opioids for what they're saying is their role in the opioid epidemic, including deaths. And that federal case is going on in Cleveland. But just late Wednesday, Judge Dan Polster there approved what was called a negotiation class, which means that those communities there are about 2,000 of those, and every community in America, so that's about 33,000 cities, counties, townships, towns, can have a say in negotiation of any settlement proposals. And that's very unusual. That's something that's not been done before.
Well, what does that mean exactly? Will 33,000 negotiations take place?
No, they'll all get a chance to vote in groups, and they'll be weighted toward communities that, like Cincinnati or Hamilton County and a couple of those in northern Kentucky, those that have suffered more deaths from overdose, those who have higher rates of addiction, those who had funneled in, had more opiates, more of these painkillers funneled into them, will be weighted so that their, you know, their vote will mean more in these settlement agreements. And it's being, you know, lauded by local officials and local people, but I know that, you know, the state attorneys general aren't thrilled with it because their option would have been to have the states kind of control these negotiations.
Yeah, you reported that Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost was, quote, less convinced. Here's part of what he said in a statement. Quote, every community has to make a determination whether they're in or out before they even know what the deal is. Local governments will have to make a big decision. And if they do nothing, that is their big decision. They're in, whether it's good, bad, or ugly. Have you heard from any local officials who share concerns about this?
You know, so far, the only local officials that I've heard from are people who are in favor of keeping all of this in the hands of the communities, and that includes our own health commissioner, as well as, you know, Tom Simon has been pretty very vocal about it, Denise Driehaus, and those with the Hamilton Heroin Coalition. Interestingly, the families of people who have been hurt by addiction are more interested in the funding going to, you know, their communities as well. They have less trust, at least those that I'm covering and hearing from. I shouldn't make a blanket statement, but they have less trust in, you know, higher levels of government getting a hold of money that they want to be able to use to treat addiction in their families and hopefully prevent new addictions.
Well, we're talking about settlement funds. Tell us where these funds originate. Who, with whom, are these governments settling?
Okay. So there were numerous lawsuits filed, as you know, Cincinnati, Hamilton County, Boone County, Campbell County are among them, Claremont, that were filed against the major farm people, their manufacturers, their distributors, the people that make the pills and distribute them. And the accusation is that those who, the manufacturers, have misrepresented the addictive risks of long-term use of opioids way back, you know, in the early 2000s to mid-2000s, and that the distributors just didn't, you know, monitor suspicious packages, like all of a sudden somebody is going to get from them an enormous number of pills, and it's a small community or a pharmacy or something like that. So these lawsuits are all about manufacturers and distributors, and the funding, the money, the settlement money, if this doesn't go to trial, will come from them.
So let's say these settlements are less chaotic than the Attorney General of Ohio predicts they will be, and everything is settled, and there are funds coming into all the communities. Are there restrictions on how they can be used?
This is something that is not completely decided, but the plaintiffs have made it clear that they should go to local communities for prevention, treatment, and helping the communities respond to what has been a devastating crisis as kind of a, you know, I guess it can't take away the pain, but it might prevent new addictions and it might alleviate some of the burden that these our communities have endured.
What do we know about a potential timeline, Terry?
You know, that is not clear to me either. I do know that there's a bellwether trial scheduled for October with Cuyahoga and Summit counties. And I know that a number of these issues, as in motions, you know, filed in court, the judge is trying to get through them before the trial comes in October. And by bellwether, it's kind of a test case, see where you know, what evidence sticks and where things go and how it goes. So October is a month to be, you know, we're keeping an eye on this closely before then and seeing whether the trial moves on.
And Terry, I know you cover the heroin beat. I hate even calling it a beat, but that is that's what you have, unfortunately. How are things looking out there now? Does it look like just the regular, I guess, overdose situation is improving at all?
Well, I think it has improved somewhat because I think that, you know, we've been saturated, and I mean that in a good way. It often has a negative connotation with Narcan, and more people are using it. There's more evidence-based treatment going on. But, you know, I think that the next arm of things has yet to be tackled, not that it's not being done at all, but this is a chronic disease, right, and there's relapse involved. And a lot of these people in recovery aren't getting what they need to get in order to be able to, you know, maintain that recovery or that remission of addiction. And they are slipping back in. So I think that's just kind of quick summary of, I think, where we are now, Michael.
Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Terry DeMeo, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
And now we're joined by Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow, who reported this week on the ongoing debate over the bailout of Ohio's nuclear power plants and some mysterious flyers showing up in mailboxes. Andy Chow is on the phone. Hi, Andy. How are you?
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. This story has had some strange developments this week, no?
It sure has. I mean, something that started as a simple energy proposal blew up into a comprehensive energy proposal, and now we've got this huge battle for the ballot, so it's definitely evolved over the month.
Okay, well, let's just start with the basics. Refresh our memory on this Ohio energy law.
Sure. So it's the new Ohio energy law through House Bill 6. So some of the big headlines, key takeaways here are that it bails out Ohio's two nuclear power plants through $150 million in annual subsidies. Every ratepayer, everyone's electric bill will go up by about 85 cents a month to pay for those subsidies. It also offers subsidies to coal plants, hundreds of millions of dollars to coal plants, through another extra charge on people's electric bills of about $1.50 a month. So that's $2.35 of extra fees every month on basically everyone's electric bills. But this bill also rolls back requirements to use renewable energy. It eliminates requirements to achieve energy efficiency. People who, like the bill, said that offsets the other rate increases. But there are people who don't like that. They say it's a bailout for nuclear. They say it's a bailout for coal. There are people who don't like the changes it makes to Ohio's green energy policies. So there are people who are trying to put this law on the ballot, calling for a referendum on HB 6.
And before we explore that a little more intensely, remind us why some leaders in the state thought that these energy companies needed to be bailed out.
So there's a couple of issues at play here. There were one school of thought is that it would save jobs. It would save about 1,400 jobs at the nuclear energy plants. Other people said that and pointing out that nuclear is a large source of non-carbon emitting energy. It provides 15% of Ohio's overall grid for energy. So closing those plants down would leave about a 15% gap. And then the other thing is, that they thought that it would cost more on electric bills if these plants were to shut down. And so keeping them open would continue grid diversity, would continue reliability through keeping these nuclear plants open.
Okay, so three stories you had this week. Briefly, I want to read the headlines and then we'll visit each of them individually. Environmental group says Ohio energy law goes against national trend. And then you have the next day, flyers push anti-Chinese government message to save the nuclear bailout. And then on Thursday, you had nuclear bailout referendum workers accuses opposition of assault. So the story is getting a little nuttier. Let's start with what the environmental group says about how this new Ohio energy law goes against the national trend.
Yeah, this all started once the bill was passed. I started looking into how does Ohio compare to other states? And you start to see that other states like California, North Carolina, I believe Georgia in some cases, the other states are looking for ways to continue their investment into renewable energies, continue looking for ways to invest in solar power, to invest in wind power, and then to also phase out their use of coal. And so the bill that Ohio ended up passing basically goes against that trend, saying that they don't want mandates on renewable energy, they don't want mandates on energy efficiency, and instead they want to subsidize coal and also in turn subsidizing nuclear. And again, that's another point where in other states they've looked for ways of phasing out nuclear because it hasn't been working in the marketplace, and instead finding a way to transition people from that job to other jobs within the same field or within the similar field of energy.
You wrote about these strange anti-Chinese government flyers that have been arriving in the mailboxes of Ohioans. It appears to have an American flag that's being overtaken by a Chinese flag. I want to read the text on it based on the photo published with your article. Quote, "In the coming weeks, don't give the Chinese government your personal information, email, cell phone, address, or sign your name on their petition. China is quietly invading our energy grid and coming for our Ohio jobs. Don't sign their petition allowing China control over Ohio." That's intense, Andy. What's that about?
It's intense, and that's the same kind of message that people are seeing on online ads and through TV advertisements as well, is this message of an anti-Chinese government sentiment. Now, so the thing behind this is it all depends on how someone decides to spin it. So the case here is that the people who want to keep the nuclear bailout in place, that group is called Ohioans for Energy Security, they're basically fighting on behalf of First Energy Solutions. Now, we don't know who their donors are, but they're fighting on behalf of that agenda and that message. And what they're saying is that who stands to benefit the most from nuclear plants closing, this group is saying who stands to benefit the most are the natural gas companies. And then if you follow that thread, well, who's investing in the big natural gas companies in Ohio? There are investors here in Ohio. There are also foreign investors from Britain, foreign investors from France, and then a Chinese state-owned bank that is also a big investor in these natural gas plants. So that's how they sort of weave their way into connecting the anti-nuclear bailout movement to the Chinese government.
Okay, so there are people out in the communities trying to collect signatures, and that's what seemed to provoke these flyers. And you also reported that one of these nuclear bailout referendum workers was assaulted and is accusing the opposition of performing that assault. What happened here?
So what we're seeing speaking broadly, what we're hearing is and seeing is that there are these petitioners who are out there, and they are being met with hostility from, people who might just be private citizens who are seeing these flyers, and also apparently through other people who are paid to follow the petitioners. So in this particular instance, in a central Ohio suburb of Dublin, someone was trying to gather signatures. They were standing outside of a library trying to get people to sign their petition to put the referendum of HB6 on next year's ballot. Now, somebody else is paid to follow that petitioner. And so I guess for a day or two, this person had been following the petitioner around. So the person collecting the signatures decided to take out his phone and take a picture of the person following him. That's when this altercation broke out. The monitor, I guess you could call her, the person who was following the petitioner, reaches her hand out, slaps the phone away, ends up shoving him. So the petitioner decides to call police. It becomes this whole altercation, and it really shed a light on what's going on the street level as far as what the petitioners are seeing as they're trying to gather signatures. The referendum group saying that this is blocking democracy, this is blocking free speech, really interfering with the process of trying to exercise their right of putting a referendum on the ballot.
Andy Chow, we'll look at whatever comes next out of this. We know you'll be on top of it. Andy Chow is from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. We appreciate you being here, Andy. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, a national magazine highlights African-American-owned businesses right here in Cincinnati. And the city's first medical marijuana dispensary is open. And Coney Island says goodbye to its rides and hundreds of employees. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Let's continue the Friday news review now with members of the news team right here at WVXU. I'm joined now by reporters Ambriel Crutchfield. Hi, Ambriel.
Hey.
We've got Ann Thompson. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Michael.
And Tana Weingartner. Happy Friday, Tana.
Hey. Glad to be here.
So we got a bunch of stories that we want to recap from the WVXU website and airwaves. Ann, we got to start with you because you've got to go do the news at the top of the hour. I want you to be ready for all the work that you're doing in there.
Exactly. So
you reported this week that Cincinnati's first medical marijuana dispensary is helping to lower prices?
Well, we don't know that for sure. That's what I was surprised when I walked up and I just kind of was talking to some people in line and that's what they were talking about. Like, ooh, do you think this is going to help lower prices now that we already have the one in Lebanon and now we have one in Cincinnati, actually in Columbia Township. And then there are two others scheduled to open in Cincinnati. I don't know how soon, but another one, in fact, in Columbia Township, less than a mile away from this one. This one's name is Verilife.
Okay, so this is sort of a simple supply and demand situation. So you create competition because now there are shops in closer proximity to one another.
That's correct. So people, even in Cincinnati, were having to drive like 45 minutes to Lebanon, and probably still a lot are. I was surprised that there weren't that many people at this opening on Wednesday. I did ask the Verilife general manager, Chaz Mize, about the fact that, you know, people were talking about the prices, and he kind of was very vague, and he certainly didn't offer up like, okay, well, we'll be lowering our prices anytime soon. So that's just these people talking. So it's, you know, we'll wait and see about that.
And so these markets, they set their own prices?
They do. And there was talk that the production costs in Ohio are still pretty high, and all the testing that has to go through that. For example, in Colorado, I understand that the prices are a lot lower. So we'll just have to kind of wait and see about that. But the news was this was the first one to open in Cincinnati.
Yeah, so you were there because it was the opening of the first one in the city proper.
And they have about the same type and selection of products as the one in Lebanon. The one in Lebanon is called About Wellness. So, and again, two other ones in Cincinnati, but we don't know when they will open.
Do they use the same suppliers? Do we know where their supply comes from?
I don't know that. But, you know, I'm assuming that they would.
Yeah, I'm wondering what that might do to the consideration for the price. Well, we'll keep an eye on that, and we know we'll hear from you soon following up with that. Ann Thompson, will let you leave because we know you have work to do. So thanks for coming in and recapping your story for us.
Thank you, Michael.
All right. Ambriel, you've had a lot of stories this week. We're glad you're joining us on this Friday news review. I want to start with your reparations story. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you covered there?
Yeah, so I went to St. Peter's United Church of Christ, and it was a multicultural, multi-generational group of people that go to the church, but also community members, just wanting to talk about reparations, like why not? If we do it, how so? Is this even something that we should be considering? So a lot of shared ideas in that. It wasn't anyone there that really opposed it strongly. So we did take to Facebook to kind of get people's take on why they may be against it and hear more about that.
And that issue even came up in Thursday night's Democratic presidential primary. So it is an issue that I'm sure you'll have to explore again because it doesn't look like that's going away anytime soon. Tell us about the Reentry Summit.
Yeah, so the Reentry Summit was just basically an event focusing on how to successfully remove some of the barriers that people that are leaving incarceration face. And one of the interesting things was we talk about job readiness and like job employment being available, but also more so focusing on how do you make sure people are transitioning and can stay in that job because they are coming from different experiences being in prison and also whatever experience they had prior to that. So
Essence Magazine gave some love to some Cincinnati business. Tell us what was going on.
Yeah, so Essence Magazine just kind of said this is the place to be if you're a Black entrepreneur. They highlighted Mortar and as well as the Minority Business Accelerator. They both kind of help Black business owners and other people get off the ground and make sure that they're scaling their business. So I just wanted to reach out to people and kind of hear what their triumphs and challenges are. And it was very interesting that a lot of it was a big trend of like, okay, if I put out there that I'm a Black business owner, sometimes that doesn't really get me a diverse pool of clientele. So very interesting there.
Well, what did you learn from these folks out there? Did they agree with the assessment of the magazine that, yeah, this is the right place to be if you're a Black entrepreneur?
Yeah, some people were kind of like, I don't know. And then other people were like, yeah, I could totally see that because we all work together. So it kind of just depends, like, how long you've been owning your business, and also, like, if you're a little bit younger, if you've been working with other people and collaborating. So mixed reviews on that, but...
Well, did this magazine, which is a traditionally Black-oriented magazine, Black mm-hmm. culture magazine, did it compare Cincinnati to any other places, or was it just an article about Cincinnati?
It was actually all about Cincinnati, so it really highlighted Mortar and the Minority Business Accelerator. I previously reported the Minority Business Accelerator got a grant from the Kauffman Foundation, so that really kind of helped them, and but their focus is more so scaling a business, like once you've reached this dollar amount, how can we get you further? Not you're just starting out, let's start from the ground.
Okay, so we're gonna bring Tana in here, but stick around, Ambriel, because this is sort of all related to FC Cincinnati.
Oh,
so
okay.
First we've got, because we have Stargell Stadium mm-hmm. and then we have Music Hall, and mm-hmm. it's noise issues, so
right.
So Stargell Stadium, what's the update on that, Ambriel?
The first game at the stadium is tonight, and I spoke to some players, which you can hear later on WVXU. Mixed emotions, like they had been playing at the old stadium since they were doing Little League, and now it's like they're ready. They're like, oh, we have to start off new, but this is some of their senior years, so they're ready to kick it off and set some standards.
All right. And I referenced FC Cincinnati because the new stadium, mm-hmm. the new football field was constructed because it was impacted by the forthcoming FC Cincinnati
right.
Stadium. And that's also impacting Music Hall again, apparently. We thought this noise issue might have been settled, but apparently not.
Both sides have their experts who say, one says it'll be fine, one says it won't be fine. What happened this week was a letter was sent. There's supposed to be a vote sometime today finalizing the plans for the new West End Stadium for FC Cincinnati. So the Music Hall Revitalization Company, who are the people that just undertook the big renovation at Music Hall, said, hey, look, this is going to be a problem. Cincinnati owns Music Hall, and the committee, this company, you know, runs it for them, basically. And they said, just FYI, we're not going to stand in the way of this vote, but we're going to have to do more work to soundproof it.
What is that work?
Well, just a lot of soundproofing.
Just,
it sounds
just
like
materials.
Just additional materials. Yeah. Now, the stadium is supposed to have these fins on it that the stadium's architects say will kind of keep the noise in. But Music Hall's architects say, well, there's nothing between the fins, so the sound's going to go right through that hole. So just additional soundproofing to keep audio out of Springer Auditorium.
And those of us here at Cincinnati Public Radio are literally stuck in the middle of this thing, aren't we?
We are literally in the middle.
Literally in the middle
for
between
now.
Our neighbors at Music Hall until we move
yeah.
someday later on. Okay, so some news out of Coney Island. Kind of
yeah.
sad for people of a certain age, maybe even our age, since we were kids who got to enjoy Coney Island for a long time. What's happening?
Well, they are getting rid of their dry side rides. Apparently, this has kind of been something they've been thinking about for a while. They surveyed people that go to Coney Island, and they said, you know, we're really just there for the water park. We're not going for the rides. So they're going to take them all out, sell them off to other amusement parks, and then use, you know, the money that they make from that, and also the money that they'll be saving, because they won't be doing maintenance on all of those rides, to pay for upgrades to the water park experience and adding to it. And that'll take about 5 years to phase in, they're saying. So it should all be finished to celebrate, I think it's the 100th anniversary of Sunlight Pool.
Do we know yet exactly what that expansion looks like?
They aren't saying. They're saying it's too soon, but if they know what it is, they're not telling me.
We saw some headlines at like 285 employees. Now, we know most of those are seasonal.
Right.
But more than a dozen
were
full-time.
Yeah, I think 13 full-time employees. So that will be a difficult transition for some people. But I imagine they'll still need to hire some seasonal folks back for they're going to still have their Christmas light the night or whatever it's called, where they drive, you know, they'll drive through and look at the lights. So, but yeah, I mean, they'll be hiring fewer seasonal workers next year.
Yeah, it's still kind of sad.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we were talking earlier. It kind of reminded me about Americana going away.
Yeah,
and we remember that.
Bar.
Yeah. All the old places.
Yep. But the lake is staying, and the swan boats and the paddle boats that out on the lake, which is kind of one of the oldest things at Coney, that stays.
So Coney says that they'll still have fun, the fun. Isn't that what they had?
I don't
the
remember
fun.
What it, the fun.
I've ruined the show
this
again.
Is going all downhill, Michael.
Tana Weingartner and Avriel Crutchfield, I appreciate both of you being here. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Dave Schwermer. Today, I'm Michael Monks.